Рейтинг Владимира Путина вышел на новый максимум.
Бьет рекорды со знаком плюс.
Его последовательное
высокий уровень одобрения работы президента.
Путин поручил Минобороны передать вооруженным силам.
Ли он переигравший Обаму, деспот ли заточивший
Владимира Путина
оплатить.
Сегодня состоялся большой разговор о событиях последних недель. It's been called a sovereign democracy, a managed democracy, and an oligarchy. But with Vladimir Putin's decision to annex Crimea and the nationalistic fervor and hunt for traitors that followed, an increasing number of Kremlin watchers are arguing that Russia is now in the process of becoming something simpler and cruder, a good old-fashioned autocracy. It's long been assumed that Putin was the frontman and decider-in-chief for an informal collective leadership that included Russia's most powerful business and political figures. This cabal has been called everything from the collective Putin to Putin's Politburo to Russia's deep state. But with Western sanctions poised to hit key members of this inner sanctum hard and reports that much of the elite was dismayed by the annexation of Crimea, it increasingly looks like Putin is turning into an autocratic ruler who is no longer constrained by his court. Is the collective Putin becoming less collective? And if so, what are the implications? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hello.
And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, also via Skype, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean. Good to see you.
Hello. Good to see you, too.
And Sean, let's start with you, since credit where credit is certainly due. You actually inspired the theme of this this podcast with a post on your blog this week called Putin's Autocratic Moment. In that post, you warmed my heart by citing Harvard University's Edward Keenan, his seminal essay, Muscovite Political Folkways, where the spiritual leader of all Kremlin watchers wrote that, quote, the Muscovite and later Russian systems tended to prefer oligarchic and collegial rule to avoid the single leader and to function best when the nominal autocrat was in fact politically weak, end quote. If Putin is in fact having his autocratic moment, then he would seem to be breaking the norm of Russian rulers. Sean, what are the implications of this?
Well, one of the implications of it is we're seeing a Putin that's no longer constrained by the people around him, right? I was inspired to do this post because I'd been reading Keenan's article. I actually assigned it to students in class and had them write papers about it. And one of the things that struck me is that the sanctions are based on the assumption that if you squeeze the oligarchs around Putin, they will squeeze Putin and then the policy will change. But this raises a question. As we talked about before, Putin has been seeking to nationalize the elite for over a year now. He's been warning that by having assets in the West, you're making yourself vulnerable to Western sanctions. And to me, it seemed that perhaps we're seeing something different here. We've heard reports about Putin making the decision to go into Crimea in a smaller circle than what we assume to be a kind of larger circle of advisors. Now he seems to be making these decisions in a smaller circle. And some of that might just be the fact that if you're going to occupy a territory and seize it, you're going to only take advice from your national security people. But nonetheless, knowing Russia being based on personal connections rather than offices, we tend to think that, well, he should consult with others, and perhaps this isn't the case, and we're seeing Putin being a far more autocratic ruler than before.
Yeah, and in your piece, you also had an interesting quotation from Yuri Kovalchuk, who is one of the figures sanctioned by the United States, not yet by Europe. He's the chairman of Bank Rossiya, which has been called the informal banker of Putin's inner circle. And he surprisingly seemed to be down with this, though, even though he is somebody who is very vulnerable. You have to wonder what people like Timchenko and the Rothenbergs think of this, who are also very, very vulnerable to these sanctions. Along the lines of whether the sanctions are a bad policy, given that maybe Putin's acting more unilaterally here, wouldn't the logic that the sanctions could indeed split the elite and put Putin in a very dangerous situation and isolate him at home and eventually harm him? Couldn't that logic work just as much as the logic of getting the elite to squeeze Putin and get him to change course?
Right. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't call the sanctions a bad policy. I think that it's one of the policies that one of the few tools the United States in particular and Europe in general has to have leverage over Putin and his decisions. But the question is, perhaps in the long term, this might end up after the kind of dust is settled and this kind of patriotic fervor we've been seeing over the last month or two so kind of quiets down. Maybe things might reconfigure itself, yeah, possibly. But for in the short term, I don't think with the patriotism that we're seeing coming out of Russia, along with Putin's popularity, which we saw in the Levada poll this week, topped 80%, it's quite unlikely that elites around Putin are going to speak out publicly, especially since speaking out publicly is already taboo for Russian elite circles. I mean, Keenan actually quotes a very funny saying in Russia, basically saying, "Don't drag your trash out of the hut."
Right.
So we're probably not going to hear any public statements by these oligarchs expressing their dissatisfaction. They're going to rally around Putin. And I think we should consider that, you know, I think we assume that these people only care about the bottom line and about profit. And we forget the fact that they might be actually patriotic people and buy into the idea that now Russia is under siege by outsiders and they rally around their leader.
Kirill, what do you think? What are your thoughts on this?
Several points. First, of course, it's very extremely interesting what's going on inside Putin's inner circle now. I mean, maybe not just one inner circle, but two inner circles. The previous one, which was larger, and the recent one. As for the first one, the recent inner circle, I think that most people, most members of this inner circle are in a desperate state of mind now because they don't know what to do. Not just because they are in a danger to lose all their assets and, you know, property outside Russia and so on. I think they can manage somehow all this stuff or part of this stuff. But of course, they're thinking about the future. The future is very bad for them now because there are two ways, or to try to emigrate somehow to some Western country and to settle there and to begin to play Berezovsky game or, you know, Gusinsky game or even Alexander Lebedev's game, yeah? Or the second way, to stay inside Russia with consequences that no one can predict for mm-hmm. them, especially for them. Secondly, I think they're desperate because there are a lot of, you know, clever men with a good experience in politics and finance and so on. I am sure that they're desperate about the quality of their advisors in Putin's circles, in Putin's circle now. How can we estimate the international politics, international course, or even the politics itself of Putin if there are such advisors like Sergei Glazyev, so-called economist who is proposing to give up U.S. dollars as an international currency and so on, like Konstantin Zatulin, like, you know, all these people, even, you know, like Dmitry Rogozin. All of them, they're absolutely, you know, they lack any experience in international relations, in economy, in, you know, whatever. So these so-called advisors, they just speak to Putin the things which he wants to hear mm-hmm. and wants to listen to. I think that among those who were, maybe who is still actually in the Putin circle, they're not so happy about this situation because we cannot speak about the reasons, about the political logic, about the rationality, even the mm-hmm. rationality of, you know, recent Putin's politics for last, you know, 1 month.
You know, people like Glazyev and Rogozin, their ideology seems to be the zeitgeist now and John was talking about the patriotic fervor. Just to give you an example of the absurd levels that this has reached, there's a bill. I don't know if either of you have seen this. There's a bill circulating in the Duma. It hasn't even gone to vote yet, but it's there. And this bill would criminalize undermining the authority of any leader of not just the Russian Federation, but the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire. So any Russian leader going back to Peter the Great, you could criminalize that. Now, the interesting thing about that is if you listen to Putin's recent speech to a joint session of parliament, he violated that. It's not a law yet. But if that bill becomes law, Putin would have violated it because he criticized Nikita Khrushchev in that speech very, very openly. And Nina Khrushcheva had a lot to say about that last week. Kirill, I know you hate historical analogies, but too bad, because I want to go to this with both of you. You're both historians, and Edward Keenan, the granddaddy of all Kremlin watchers and the granddaddy of all Russian of all Western historians of Russia, deservedly, I say that with admiration. He says that the norm is the collective leadership model in Russia. It's the norm. Putin's breaking from the norm. Who else in the past has broken from the norm, and how has that worked? And I think there's some obvious answers here, but I'll let you historians have the floor.
I think the most Russian leaders that we consider the most autocratic are ones that tried to break this kind of clan hold on them, this kind of imprisoning them within a collective leadership. Ivan Grozny being one, Peter the Great being the other, and Stalin being the third. Mm-hmm. And these are the ones that are kind of the quintessential models for kind of autocratic rule in Russia or dictatorial rule in Russia. And the question that – and I was thinking about those three leaders, and I was writing this post because I was wondering if this – the sanctions does have the kind of ironic effect where it allows for Putin to consolidate his power over his oligarchs and break from their constraint even more.
Now, those three, at least two of those three that you mentioned are notorious, but all three of them, I mean, I hate to use the word success and Stalin in the same sentence, but were successful leaders by their own standards, right? Mm-hmm. So is Putin going for greatness here?
I think that remains to be seen. I mean, I think to see what the effects of this policy are going to be in the long term. I mean, we're getting some kind of dark projections, particularly for the economy. I mean, Kudrin came out yesterday and predicted what $120 to $150 million capital flight for this year, zero economic growth. He put forward a very, very dark future for Russia's economy. But you know, greatness isn't always measured in economic success, right? Greatness is also recognized as a great leader of power. Mm-hmm. And one has to wonder if Putin, in the kind of twilight of his years, is thinking more about history rather than the present.
And he'll be called either Vladimir Veliki or Vladimir Grozny. Kirill, your thoughts on this, that basically Putin's breaking the mold of what is the norm in Russia, this collective leadership. Sean pointed out these three examples, Ivan Grozny, Peter the Great, and Joseph Stalin. Would you say those are the three main examples of breaking the mold?
First example is not conclusive because Ivan the Terrible he left the country in a disastrous state. Mm-hmm. After his death, in all possible aspects, political, economical, social, whatever. So-called smutnoe vremya, all this, civil war in the beginning of 17th century and all the situation which, lasted till the middle of 17th century, actually, was the result of Ivan the Terrible's rule. So it's not a proof. Peter the Great, of course, yes, but he changed the game at all. Totally. Mm-hmm. He was not. It's interesting if you return to the quotation from Keenan when he said Moscovites. I think he meant the pre-Peter the Great.
Yes, it's exactly. That's precisely
and
what he meant.
That is the most important thing, because speaking historically, of course, the very concept of the monarch's rule in so-called Moscow Russia before Peter the Great was a sort of collective, mm-hmm. because
But he said Muscovite and later Russian systems is the quote from the essay. And I've interviewed Professor Keenan a number of times, and he argues this continued into the Soviet period and into Putin's Russia. It's this collective style leadership with a nominal oligarch who is in fact not really as all powerful as he or she looked from the outside. So, but continue. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. But formally, we can make an analogy with Moscow, Russia, with even Brezhnev's times, because of course there was not such thing or such ruler as Brezhnev. That was a collective Brezhnev, and that's very important. The very idea of the so-called Central Committee of CPSU and so on was the idea of so-called Boyarskaya Duma, which surrounded, Moscow monarchs before Peter the Great. So in some sense, formally, so I'm stressing formally, of course, we can find this comparison to pre-empire time. But the difficulty is that Putin now, he's a ruler of a so-called not just post-Soviet country, he's a ruler of a post-empire country, and at the same time, he's a head of a country which is at the same time trying to be so-called national state, in the modern political terminology, and at the same time, it's a multi-ethnic federation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the most important thing and the most important danger for this patriotic fervor or all this, stuff which we, look at now. So I wonder how, it's just a footnote to our subject, but I wonder how, population of Tartar Republic is now watching all this stuff around Crimea and Tatar.
I'm hoping to do a podcast on that in the very near future, if not next week, in the very near future. And I want to invite somebody from our Tatar Bashkir service here at RFERL to participate in that podcast. But yeah, that's the Tatar issue is going to be very interesting. One other thing I wanted to go into as well is that how it's clear how you rule in the collective sense, right? But if you're gonna go unilateral and not rely on this collective Putin, what other lessons can we draw from the past about how you have to rule? I mean, you have to become an autocrat, which means you have to really crack heads. There's all sticks and no carrots, or are there carrots too?
Well, I think there will be one way to rule is to make analogy to Stalin. I mean, Stalin was surrounded by a very, very small circle of people, of very strong loyalists to him that basically, it was kind of an echo chamber in many ways. So you don't really get a lot of outside input into that smaller, that shrunken circle. And I do think you possibly could crack heads, but that is also requires if heads actually, try to make waves. And if anything, the implications of this potential new model, and of course it's only speculation. We don't really know if this is the case or not. But if this is the new model that Putin is becoming more autocratic and amongst a smaller circle of advisors, he'll always have advisors. It's just that it would be a shrunken circle.
And it's advisors who are. It's not a collective leadership anymore.
Right.
That's the key. There's going to be advisors, but what was about the Putin system and the Yeltsin system? There was a collective Yeltsin.
Right.
A collective. But continue. I want
to. Yeah. Then we're going to have to change our understanding of how we understand Putin's actions and the way Russia is ruled, and therefore what I'm calling for is perhaps a new form of analysis.
No, that's one of the reasons I wanted to discuss this, because it did get me thinking and it challenges a lot of the assumptions that we've all had. If this in fact is the case, and these are early days and this is still playing out, and I'm still wondering what the effect these sanctions are going to have on what we used to call the collective Putin, and if it's going to lead to splits in it. I was on a program yesterday with our Belarusian service, and the director of our Belarusian service, Alexander Lukashuk, was very skeptical about Western sanctions against Putin for good reason. They didn't work. Belarusian president Lukashenko has been under sanctions for how long? And it hasn't had any effect. But I said, listen, Alexander, I know you're skeptical about sanctions, but Belarus and Russia aren't the same. Russia's not Belarus. Belarus is not integrated into the world economy to the extent at all, never mind to the extent that Russia is. Members of the Belarusian elite do not have villas in the south of France or luxury apartments in London or trading in the city of London and have assets in the city of London and so on and so forth. So in a lot of ways, the Russian elite is very vulnerable to this outside pressure. But the question is, does that vulnerability extend to Putin? Is it easier to withstand these sanctions if you're an autocratic leader? Yeah, if you have the rest of your elite ready to take the hit and frightened enough of you to take that hit without fighting back. Kirill, what do you think?
I think I can't agree with Alexander Lukashuk, of course, because you're absolutely right. Belarusian economy is in a state, quite successful, by the way, in a state of so-called autarkia. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with a lot of Russian subsidies, but yeah.
Anyway, they can survive on themselves. But Russian economy, they produce just. So I don't want to quote this famous British actor who told what Russian produced, except vodka and pessimism. That was actually Hugh Laurie. But speaking frankly, that they produce just oil, gas, and immigration.
Yeah.
And that's all. And you can't survive just if Putin, tried to prepare all these, recent events, 5-10 years ago, he must establish another sort of economy. Just like, South Korean or Chinese.
Well,
or
this
whatever.
Is what I mean. And is the Russian elite ready to accept that? And are the Russian people ready to accept that? I mean, Putin, I think over time, in the long run, he's going to find himself increasingly isolated, no?
I think that it's a question when we speak about politics, and we now are speaking about politics, not about the economy.
Well, they're related, I think.
Yes, yes. But now we're speaking about the political will. So the question is, if Russian elite has a real political will to survive in their previous state, or they must be or ought to be transformed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
Well, this is the thing. Go ahead, Sean. You wanted to say
something. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what this moment actually does is it makes the elite decide which side they're on.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think this is what this Kovalchuk statement that I quoted is exactly this. It's you have to pick a side now. And the ones that want to flee, the ones that want to go to the West, well, then let them go to the West. The ones that want to be patriotic and stay with Russia and back the great Russian state, then they have to choose a side and be back that. I mean, I think this is the moment that's facing the Russian elite. And perhaps over the next several months, we might see splitting off. But I think in that splitting off, you might get a consolidation within Russia of elites that back Putin.
Yeah, in an economy whose decline is going to be accelerated by the isolation that is sure to come. I mean, the news reports today of like troops amassing all over the Russian-Ukrainian border. I know in Kyiv they think, and there's a lot of people think an invasion is imminent. I'm not sure what I think about that, but there is a lot of troop now. A movement into mainland Ukraine would certainly accelerate the isolation of Russia right now. And what is that going to do to the economy? I guess the last thoughts before we move on to the second half is what do you think? Can Kirill, you suggested this implies a complete political transformation in Russia. It also implies an economic transformation more towards our autarky. If you're going to be, pulling out of the world economy and not reaping its benefits, can Russia do that? Can Russia do that?
If you're asking me,
is it sustainable?
I can say no, because if for the last 20 years they couldn't found and develop their other type of economy than, exporting gas and oil, it cannot, do this in, 1 year or 2 years or 3 years and so on. Especially in the recent situation of the sanctions and so on. So if you are in a very good relationship with the outer world, if you can allow a lot of investments into your so-called real economy, yeah, and so on. Okay, that's possible.
Can they pivot to Asia and China, perhaps?
Yeah.
I mean, but this is going to be a wholesale transformation. In a way.
And I think it's just a fake problem. Of course, cannot. Of course, Russia cannot do this in 1, 2, and 3 years, because if to do this thing on the modern, you know, technology basement or foundation and so on, they must be a part of the outer, you know, the whole world, and that's all.
Yeah. Sean, your thoughts?
I mean, this, as you said, this would take a massive reconfiguration of Russia's economy and politics toward, and I think it would be reconfigured toward the East. And for a long time, we've been wondering, what is the kind of point of Putinism now? Mm-hmm. What is the kind of what are they offering the population? And perhaps this, and this is pure speculation, perhaps this allows for a new reconfiguration where they can develop their internal market. You're seeing some, you know, you saw yesterday there was a call for a national payment system to counteract Visa and MasterCard. Mm-hmm. You're getting Medvedev is making statements about the need to produce food for the internal market of Russia and stop importing so much. Perhaps this kind of, you know, end of, if you consider that in the desire to develop the Far East, perhaps this is the trigger which will move Russia more towards China and more towards the East, especially if you consider the fact that when Putin looks around the West, not only does he feel betrayed by them, but he sees an economic model that, according to him, is full of crisis. Mm. You know, he looks at 2008, he looks at Greece, he looks at the EU as a whole, and he perhaps sees too much destabilization. And the one thing that we know about Putin, at least until this moment, is that he favored stability over anything.
Right. So.
but perhaps this could trigger, at least, and we see more talk of this in the Russian press, particularly in the conservative press, of the desire to move, pivot toward the East and decouple from the West.
But that's a project that takes decades, and they may not have decades politically. That's the thing. Well, we'll leave it at that for now. There's plenty more to discuss on this on future podcasts. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and take a look at how the Russian annexation of Crimea is playing among ethnic Russians elsewhere in the former Soviet Union. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. And joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, also via Skype, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Russia needs an inflow of a new labor force. There is a need for intelligent, educated, industrious people who do not simply want to make some money here and leave, but who intend to move, settle down in Russia, and who consider Russia their motherland. I'm ordering to develop a procedure of a speedy granting of citizenship for our compatriots, bearers of the Russian language and Russian culture, direct descendants, those who have been born both within the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union.
That, of course, was Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking at his most recent State of the Union address about ethnic Russians in the former Soviet Union and perhaps giving them Russian citizenship. And this points to another important issue that's very, very timely right now. Crimea isn't unique. There are large concentrations of ethnic Russians throughout the former Soviet Union, in eastern and southern Ukraine, in NATO members like Estonia and Latvia, throughout Belarus and Moldova, and in northern Kazakhstan. And they are increasingly seen by the Kremlin as an easily deployable geopolitical weapon. Joining us for the second half of our program is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent at RFERL and a native of a heavily Russified region of northern Kazakhstan. Welcome back to the podcast, Mirhat.
Hi.
And Mirhat, let's get the ball rolling with you. Give us a sense of the attitudes among ethnic Russians in northern Kazakhstan. You're from there. You're an American citizen now, but you're from there, and you're very much in contact with a lot of these people. Are they pro-Kremlin? Do they want to join Russia? Are there divisions? How to look at this group?
It is very complicated. We're talking not only about northern Kazakhstan. We're talking about western Kazakhstan. We're talking about eastern Kazakhstan, especially. All this north, even central Kazakhstan, with the place where millions and millions of ethnic Russians, Lithuanians, Belarusians, you name it, ethnic Germans, were sent by Stalin. Many of them, when Putin was talking, he was not talking only about ethnic Russians. He was talking about Russian speakers.
Yes.
Who consider themselves those who bury Russian culture.
And who were, what did he say, born in the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, after what's happening in Crimea, what we notice there, even among my friends, well, it's very hard for me to talk to them sometimes, but the pro-Russian sentiments are very high there right now. Not like as they want to join Russia, because if you look at them and during the polls, they say, no, it's not going to happen here. We are not Crimea. It's completely different. We don't have Banderovtsi. Everything is fine. Everybody's happy.
What are their attitudes towards the Kazakh government, towards the regime?
Well, believe it or not, in Kazakhstan, Nazarbayev is mostly supported by non-Kazakhs.
Uh-huh.
He's very popular among non-Kazakhs, most of all because of the economic wealth. I mean, economically, it's not wealth. I mean, economically, Kazakhstan is doing much better than like people in Siberia next door or people in Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. The gastarbeiters or migrant workers from Uzbekistan and Tajikistan go not only to Russia, but also to Kazakhstan. But if the poll was organized in Crimea, let's say 3 or 4 months ago, they would say the same. We're doing well here. We don't need it and stuff like that. But to just switch it on, all this thing, and to organize this, it's very easy.
Right.
And here is why. Because, let's say, for Uralskaya Oblast, or West Kazakhstan, or Ural Oblast, or Uralskaya Oblast, for many Russians, it's a symbol. It's the Uralskaya Kazachestvo, and many of them still remember. This is a part of Russian history. Mm-hmm. Rasputin's house, where Rasputin grew up, was taken away from North Kazakhstan when Yegor Gaidar was still prime minister, mm-hmm. and taken to Tobolsk somewhere. Kornilov, the founder of White Army against Bolsheviks, was born in Ruskomenogorsk, mm-hmm. in my native city, in eastern Kazakhstan. And eastern Kazakhstani capital today, Ruskomenogorsk, was part of Novonikolaevskaya gubernia. He was part of Tomskaya gubernia, mm-hmm. and was part of Semipalatinskaya gubernia when the Semipalatinskaya gubernia became a part of Kazakhstan, the small town of Ruskomenogorsk. You know, this is all again about like Crimea. It's like Crimea was a part of Russia, then became part of Ukraine. Here in Kazakhstan, we have an even worse situation because, let's say, first capital of Kazakhstan, Orenburg, now it's Russia. All those borders were changing all the time, and Orenburg Oblast became part of Russia only because to isolate Bashkortostan and Tatarstan, uh-huh. so that they could not have a status of Soviet
Union Republic
and had no right to secede if they want to. So this is very complicated. But the only thing I want to add here, I don't think that scenario at this point is going to happen simply because Nazarbayev agrees to be to
loyal.
Have Kazakhs very loyal and Kazakhstan is a part of the so-called customs union, and even being loyal, Kazakhstan abstained yesterday.
Yeah, I know. So. I know. Well, you have to wonder if the kind of the ethnic Russian population of Kazakhstan is just a lever that they can use in the future against Nazarbayev, or a future Kazakh leader who is not as pliant as Nazarbayev.
I think it's not only that. I think Putin, in a very smart way, sent a message.
Mm.
It's just a message to people like Nazarbayev saying that if tomorrow something happens and you're not going to be, and Kazakhstan is going to leave the customs union or any other projects and stuff, it's a simple message to Nazarbayev. And I'm not sure that today anything like in Crimea is possible now, but it's not possible not because Putin doesn't want it. I think Putin doesn't need it. at this point.
At this point, yeah. No. But also one has to wonder if this strategy of pan-Russism, is what I'm calling it, has a limited shelf life. I mean, it's been more than two decades since the Soviet Union broke up, and you're already seeing that the ethnic Russians and the Russophone outside of Russia and the former Soviet Union are not so monolithic. Okay, ethnic Russians in Estonia, at least those that have Estonian passports and therefore EU passports, are quite content right now. Are quite content. Sure, they got their gripes and they'd like the Russian language to have more status in the country, but they're not. They don't want to join Russia. They got an EU passport. They can work anywhere in Europe. They can travel anywhere in the world without a visa. So you're seeing, and as you pointed out, even inside Kazakhstan among the Russians, the opinion isn't so yes, monolithic. In Georgia, much of the ethnic Russian population is actually pro-Tbilisi. In southern and eastern Ukraine, there's a lot of pro-Moscow sentiment, but it's far from unanimous. It's far from unanimous at all. Kirill, what do you think? Do you see ethnic Russians in these countries becoming less pro-Moscow over time? Will the pull of Moscow become less and less as time passes?
I think that the process we are watching now is the process of sort of archaization of the foreign policy of Russia. Because in previous 20 years, that was an idea of so-called post-Soviet world. Yeah, post-Soviet world, which is in some sense a sort of a democratic prolongation of Soviet Union. So we'll establish several independent states on the place of former Soviet Union and try to start our brave new world from the, you know, relatively from the zero. On my opinion, what we are watching now, it's the failure, total failure of the whole idea of post-Soviet world at all. The Union of Independent Countries and all this organization now are absolutely just, you know, just fake. It's not really, all this stuff doesn't exist. And instead of this, Putin is proposing the idea of so-called Russian world. Russian world, which is a sort of, you know, collection of various groups of people who are quite unhappy to speak Russian in different countries.
Quite unhappy to speak Russian?
Yes, quite unhappy, because the consequences for them now are much worse than to those who are, you know, if you are saying about the population of Crimea and so on, are much worse. Because if they live, say, in Kazakhstan or even in Estonia, Latvia, and so on, they are becoming an object of a... they're becoming as suspects, you know, in the eyes of the local governments and local population. And I think that we'll see that the situation with the Russian population in all these post-Soviet countries will worsen in the nearest time. Mm-hmm. Because Putin made these people a sort of hostages of his politics.
Mm. But that said, over time, do you think that the magnetic pull of Moscow will become less for them, and they will become merely people, Kazakh citizens who happen to speak Russian, and Ukrainian citizens who happen to speak Russian? What do you think, Sean? Do you think the magnetic pull will decrease?
I would think it would decrease over time. I don't hear, and I'm not, of course, paying much attention to it, but you don't really hear outside of, say, Transnistria, a lot of Russians that are in the diaspora clamoring to rejoin with Russia right now. But what really strikes me about this rhetoric on the part of Putin is that it's incredibly disturbing, because it's inherently an expansionist ideology, this kind of gathering of the Russian peoples. You know, in his speech before the 2 weeks ago, he spoke, it's played into his idea of Russians as a victimized people, mm-hmm. the fact that they're split, they're the largest diaspora, the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, broke the Russian people into parts, and here he sees himself as someone who's going to, at least the way he's speaking, that he's going to be the one that reunites the Russian land with the Russian people. And for Russia's neighbors, and I do agree that this certainly sends a signal not only to people like Nazarbayev, but it sends a signal to people to the Baltic states. It certainly sends a signal to Ukraine. It sends a signal to perhaps Poland and certainly in the Caucasus as well. And this kind of rhetoric will inevitably worsen relations between those states and Russia. And I think what Kirill just said needs to be considered, the fact that by this rhetoric is turning Russians, say, within Ukraine, and we see this in eastern Ukraine, Russians are now suspect people. Mm-hmm. They're seen as agents of Moscow, and this could have, you know, disastrous effects on their relations with their home government.
He may be trying to create a self-fulfilling prophecy there, right?
Very much
But, Mirkat, what do you think? I mean, you're kind of closer to this than the rest of us. Do you see, over time, ethnic Russians in Kazakhstan or elsewhere becoming less drawn to Moscow and more in less prone to this kind of being used as pawns this way?
I think the only one thing which will bring them to that point is to create a situation not only economically but democratically. They are feeling better there.
Mm-hmm.
There were many cases, I know them personally, when ethnic Russians, not only Russians, left for Siberian cities and other places. I'm not talking about Soskovets, who is from, or Zhirinovsky, who are from Kazakhstan. They came back. The majority of them returned. They were not able to get roots there. And that was about economy. Mm-hmm. But if Kazakhstan tomorrow is more democratic, which is not the case, unfortunately, is more open. It's open for investments, but not in terms of the human rights. We know what's happening in Zhanaozen in 2011 and other things. So then, of course, Russians, and not only Russians, non-Kazakhs, let's put it this way, living in Kazakhstan would be less and less interested in going somewhere. Even ethnic Germans, there are about 1 million ethnic Germans who left Kazakhstan after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Some of them are returning today.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Not many, of course. Not many. Mm-hmm. But some of them are returning. Elderly people who were not able to adapt there, but also young people as well. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, you said interestingly that this will be the pull of Moscow will be less to the extent that they feel democratically comfortable in these countries.
One of the example is the ethnic large ethnic minority in Kyrgyzstan, ethnic Uzbeks. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened in 2010, they're still reluctant to go to Uzbekistan.
Because
Kyrgyzstan is much more open than Uzbekistan.
Right.
This is one of the
examples. Well, you have to wonder if people in Crimea are going to have buyer's remorse pretty soon, basically. Because inside Ukraine, which is, for all its faults, and there are many, is a pretty democratic state by post-Soviet standards. Crimea had an enormous amount of autonomy inside Ukraine, and people in Crimea had the right to, you know, express their opinions the fundamental rights were not truly violated there. How are they going to like it inside Putin's power vertical of being just another subject of the Russian Federation? One of our Russian service correspondents, Andrei Sharagradsky, just got back from Crimea and did a report for us in which he said that the euphoria that happened after the referendum and the formal accession into Russia is beginning to wear off because people are starting to worry about very, very practical things. Am I going to be able to keep my business open? What's going to happen to my bank? And things like this. They're worried about rich Russian businessmen coming in and taking over all of the choice real estate. And you have to wonder what's going to happen there when reality begins to set in. And you have to wonder if there's going to be some kind of buyer's remorse. Sean, looking at this historically, I can't help but recall the 19th century Pan-Slavism movement, right? And the Russian Empire's attempt to use that for geopolitical advantage. I mean, this ended up alienating Western Slavs like the Czechs. And I mean, God, the first Pan-Slavic Congress was right here in Prague. But it ended up alienating Western Slavs like the Czechs and particularly the Poles, who began to see this as an instrument of the foreign policy of the Russian Empire and distance themselves from it. You have to wonder, like, within this Pan-Rusism, if you're going to begin to see the same process or no?
I mean, you spoke about buyer's remorse. I think I recall seeing a poll somewhere, I think it was on the Washington Post, about Abkhazia and South Ossetia, where you do seem to get some sentiment of buyer's remorse. Now, they're not formally incorporated into Russia, but they're kind of de facto incorporated into Russia. And you do see a lot of discontent there since 2008. So you could get, you know, in these pockets of Russian populations in Central Asia, but also in the Western borderlands, you could certainly see they may like the idea of Russians uniting, but the actual being united under Putin's Russia may not be the best thing for them in the end.
No, and it's interesting you mentioned Abkhazia. I was in Abkhazia back in 2009, and this is the sentiment I got, is that we didn't fight for our independence from Georgia to become a colony of Russia. We don't want to be a colony of Russia. We want to be independent.
Right.
So it's there's some interesting dynamics that are going to play out there, too. Kirill, what do you think? I know you hate historical analogies, but too bad. What do you think of the pan-Slavism analogy? Do you think this pan-Rusism is going to follow this same route, and you will see a kind of the attempts of Russia to use this as a foreign policy tool will eventually repel some ethnic Russians abroad?
The very idea of pan-Slavic unity and so on had been invented in the 19th century by several philologists and publicists. And there are a lot of, you know, academic stuff about this. And the very idea that, you know, say, Poles, Czechs, and Russians are in somehow the same people was obviously stupid for the, you know, lot of population of those Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Although initially there was enthusiasm for them among the Czechs and the Poles, but they lost their enthusiasm for it when it began to be seen as an instrument of Russian foreign policy. I was wondering if you take this down to forget the pan-Slavism, but just except for the parallel, but the pan-Rusism, if the same kind of process isn't going to kind of where Russians in Estonia are going to start to think, we're not this is not what we're about. We're Russian, but we're different. We're Western Russians, or so to speak, or something like that. If you'll begin to see this peeling off, just like we saw with other Slavs rejecting the pan-Slavism movement, that's what I'm trying to get at.
So I think that you're taking the enthusiasm of several hundred intellectuals in Austro-Hungarian and Russian Empire for the sentiments.
No, I'm talking about the Russian Empire's attempts to use this as a foreign policy tool, which they did.
And successfully till to some extent. And the disappointment, so first of all, exclude Poles.
No, the Poles got it. They distanced themselves from it, but quick.
Now we're speaking just about the Bulgars, about Czechs.
No, but I'm talking about I'm talking about if a similar process will carry itself out with ethnic Russians.
Again and again, that was an intellectual construction, so intellectual concept, which was used as a tool in the international relationships in the end of 19th century, the beginning of 20th century. That's all. Now it's absolutely forgotten. If we speak about the pan-Russian sentiments and so on, I'd like to offer you another one term. It's a pan-post-Soviet sentiment. So the point of self-identification is not national, but cultural, and this sort of culture is post-Soviet culture. So for all these people, to be Russian is to share several hundred or several thousand things, like, you know, late Soviet cinemas and
Alla Pugachova.
Alla Pugachova and so on. So we must, so it's very serious. We must analyze and speak about what actually is the point of identification for all these people.
Sean, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about less how it works with Russians in the diaspora, but how it works in Russians back home. Because this is what really disturbs me about this rhetoric coming from Putin. Until this point, he mostly spoke in a kind of Rasisky, Russia as a multi-ethnic state. Mm-hmm. And now he's speaking in ethnic terms.
Yeah.
And I wonder how this is going to play out with the non-Russian minorities within Russia itself. Yeah. Especially since this kind of aligns Putin with some very kind of unsavory elements within Russia that are asking for, you know, Ruski for Russian, for Russia for Russians, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, he's shifted from the Rossianini to the Ruski. He's gone from what Mark Eliade calls a state nationalism to an ethnic nationalism. I want to pick up on Kirill's point here about this kind of pan post Sovietism. Since we got two of you right here from different parts of the former Soviet Union, we got Kirill from Nizhny Novgorod and Merkat from northern Kazakhstan. I forget the exact town, but
Uskhaminogorsk.
That's right. Yep. What do you think of this point, Merkat? Is the touchstone, the common touchstone, kind of a post-Sovietism, or is it an ethnic Russian?
Well,
does it go beyond ethnic Russians? Are you nostalgic for Alla Pugachova?
not so much. Sometimes I listen. Well, my wife likes it, but I prefer Deep Purple and Nazareth. When I
was true American.
yeah. Well, the thing is, it's very complicated. Well, we know that, let's say, in Azerbaijan, even a leader of a communist party sent a letter to Putin after what happened in Crimea, asking to resurrect Soviet Union, and this is exactly proves what.
Right, what Kirill
said. We know that even among those officials in Russia who were included in the list of sanctions, many have Ukrainian surnames.
Mm-hmm.
Matviyenko was born and grew up in Ukraine. She is ethnic Ukrainian, as far as I know. And even the journalists who are I forgot her first name, Skobeda, I think Ludmila Skobeda.
Ulyana.
Yeah. Ulyana Skobeda, well, this is pure Ukrainian or Belarusian surname for me. And I was very nostalgic about USSR, about the Soviet Union and stuff. Yeah, to some extent, Kirill is very right. It's about culture, it's about stuff. But I have to remind, Kirill is an ethnic Russian. He grew up in Russia. I grew up in eastern Kazakhstan. I remember when I first came to the kindergarten from a remote village, I was a small boy of 4 years old. I couldn't speak Russian. It was my first time to see a very clean, wonderful premises where children were sitting, four kids at each desk and having breakfast. And I was given my place. I sat there and they asked my name. Even though I couldn't speak Russian, I understood what they're asking and I told them my name. Immediately, two girls stood up and said, we are not going to sit with a Kazakh. And this is not happening in Russia, it's happening in Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. That kind of things are experiences of every non-Russian, or if not every, that many, since their childhood. When I have a lot of Russian friends, when we had some quarrels or even street fights, very often I never cared who was my enemy and I was fighting against them. And then my friends somehow were sitting, well, we have beaten Kazakhs right now. I said, wait a minute, I'm a Kazakh here too. And there were Russians on the other side as well. What are you talking about? So this kind of things play a huge role when you grew up in the Soviet Union. Soviet Union, every person, we have many things in common, but our experiences growing up in this country are very different. One of our colleagues, Maria Korti, once told me that, well, so what? When I told the story about it, so what? He said, I grew up in South America, and everybody called me dirty Italian. I said, okay, imagine South American coming to Rome and calling all Italians there dirty Italians. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit different.
Right.
That's a little bit different.
No, I'm glad you had the opportunity to tell that story. I was going to prompt you to tell that story because I wanted you to tell that story. I would also add that it's strange to hear Merkat saying he couldn't speak Russian because there are few people, Russians included, that speak better Russian than Merkat.
That was a drag.
Along with every other language of the former Soviet Union, I might add. This man's got more languages than...
Yeah, that was one of the drives. We had four ethnic Kazakhs in the class. It was a Russian school. There were no Kazakh schools in a Kazakhstani city. It's one of the other examples of Russification. And all these four kids, three girls and me, were the best in the class. That was one of the drives to show that we are the same people and we can do better.
Now, when I have a Russian language question in the newsroom, Merkat can back this up. He's my first go-to guy when I need some complexity in the Russian language explained to me. Well, I guess on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been Kirill Kobrin, editor of the Moscow-based history and sociology magazine NZ. joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Also via Skype has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And with me in our studio in Prague is Mirhat Sharipjan, a senior correspondent with RFURL's Central Newsroom and former director of our Kazakh service. Thanks to all of you for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our superhuman, overworked producer Tanya Koncheva and my totally awesome colleague Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and definitely should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.